This is Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. This week on Writer's Voice, we explore the resistance to chattel slavery from the slave ports of Africa to the New World. First, we talk with historian Sudhir Hazara Singh about his remarkable new book, Daring to be Free, Rebellion and Resistance of the Enslaved in the Atlantic World. Then we revisit a 2012 conversation with Jacqueline Sheehan about The Comet's Tale, her novel about Sojourner Truth. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or writersvoice.net. There are many books that examine the history of the Atlantic slave trade, but few that do what Sudhir Hazara Singh's Daring to be Free does: provide a sweeping and transformative look at the history of the resistance to slavery by the enslaved themselves. His book challenges long-held myths about slavery by restoring the enslaved to the center of their own story. Hazara Singh reveals a vast, interconnected world of rebellion, from African spiritual and military resistance to shipboard uprisings, maroon communities of escapees, everyday acts of defiance, and the revolutionary movements that culminated in Haiti's independence. In our conversation, we talk about the courage of figures like Solitude of Guadalupe, the overlooked leadership of women, and the powerful networks of solidarity that spanned continents. And we explore how these acts of resistance continue to shape our understanding of freedom today. Let's listen now. Your book counters the common belief that Africans collaborated widely with European slavery without resistance. But your introduction opens with a powerful story of Solitude, a Guadeloupean freedom fighter whose history was nearly erased. So tell us about her and what her story tells us.
So Solitude was, as you mentioned, born in the Caribbean island of Guadeloupe. She was emancipated in 1794 when slavery was abolished by the French Republic. And then in 1802, when Napoleon sent his armies back to restore slavery in Guadeloupe, she joined all the men and women who started to resist. And she was a very brave fighter. She was unfortunately captured and executed in November 1802, but she remained defiant, like all the resistors, until the very end. And her story was more or less erased for the 19th century and much of the 20th century. And it's only just recently that her story and that of so many other anonymous freedom fighters has been recovered. And that's why I wanted to open with her tale, because I think it's very symptomatic of this entire hidden story that I think we need to re-engage with.
Symptomatic in what way was her story emblematic?
Well, for a long time, when people talked about the resistance of enslaved men and women, they tended to talk about leaders, they tended to talk about men rather than women, and they tended to talk about the major rebellions or insurrections. So they would talk about Haiti, and very often Haiti was described as the only successful slave insurrection. So the assumption there was that enslaved people elsewhere were not really resisting or even were being very passive in accepting their fate. And of course, what you see when you start thinking about the phenomenon of chattel slavery is that people are resisting it from the very outset. And the people who are resisting it are men, are women, are children as well. You know, one of the fascinating things I discovered is that children were transported on board these terrible slave ships, on which there were many insurrections and revolts. And very often it was the children who made those revolts possible by smuggling weapons below deck and helping organize these forms of resistance.
In fact, you write that resistance was integral to the practice of Atlantic slavery and an inescapable part of it. So let's start back in Africa, because a lot of times, to the degree that we know anything about resistance, it tends to be after the enslaved have been brought to the New World. Talk about the resistance in Africa itself. What were some of the means that it used? And the people that were engaged in it.
Well, this was for me the part of the story which I learned the most from, because I knew very little about what had happened in Africa, except that over 12 million people had been captured and put on these terrible slave ships. But actually, when you start doing the research, you see that from the very moment slave raiding parties are sent out to the African hinterland, which is where most of the men and women were captured, people living in small villages, little towns. But from the moment they encounter these slave raiders, they begin to resist. They organize themselves in defense militias. Even when they're captured, they resist the people who are trying to take them down to the coast. And even when they're down waiting to be put on board these slave ships, they try and escape from these barracks. And I have found evidence that many of the slave revolts that take place on board the slave ships were actually planned while the enslaved were being held on the coasts of West Africa. So almost all of the forms of resistance that we see in the Caribbean and in the Americas were actually initiated in Africa itself.
And talk about how this resistance was not only against the Europeans who came, but also against African leaders or governments, to the extent that we can call them governments themselves. Because we have this story that's come down that African leaders themselves collaborated. So, to what degree was there collaboration? To what degree was there resistance? And how much of that resistance was actually internal to Africa?
Well, when one looks at what's happening among the African rulers, you see that initially there is some opposition to Atlantic slavery. But of course, African rulers were very often in a position of disadvantage because they didn't have the means to resist European slave raiders. And also, they were very often induced to cooperate by bribes, by being bought off. So the phenomenon of cooperation between African elites and Europeans is a very real one. And in a sense, I think there's almost a division between the elites in Africa, and particularly the elites in the larger empires, who are active participants in the transatlantic slave trade, and the peoples who, by and large, do not accept the Atlantic slave trade and resist it actively.
And Sudhir Hazare Singh, in this book, Daring to Be Free, you cite sources, and you were just mentioning sources that you had discovered new information from. One of them is the oral history database of 7,000 African captives that was compiled from Vodun priests in Benin. How do the sources that you revealed in this one in particular reshape our understanding of who the enslaved were and what skills and worldviews they carried with them?
Well, it was absolutely fascinating to discover this oral tradition, because what it allows us to do is to reconstitute this world of people who were captured, sold into slavery. Many of them were soldiers, but there were also people who were part of governing elites. Very often, if there was a war between two African states, the party that was defeated had its leadership, both political and religious, sold into slavery. So very often you had extremely educated people and people who were very well trained militarily who ended up in chattel slavery. And that helps explain why the phenomenon of military resistance, once these men and women go to Africa, is so prevalent, because these are people who are very often soldiers themselves. So resistance is something that comes naturally.
And talk also about the spiritual and religious traditions that informed the resistance, both in Africa and in the New World.
So this was something really important, which I also hadn't anticipated. But one of the things that, in a sense, underlies the phenomenon of resistance is that African peoples who end up in chattel slavery turn back to their religious traditions as a way of preserving their identities and protecting themselves from the slavers. So you see this with the religion which I describe as Obeah, which is a natural African religion. And you see it also with Islam, where many people from West Africa had been converted to the Islamic faith. And these people retain their religious traditions and draw upon them in order to fortify their resistance against enslavement. And Obeah is particularly fascinating because it's used both as a way of protecting men and women from the ravages of enslavement, but it's also used as an instrument for planning resistance, also trying to counter the evil, the sorcery, which Obeah priests would describe slavery as.
And, you know, as indicated by what we spoke about at the top of this conversation with the story of Solitude, the Guadeloupean freedom fighter, women appear throughout your narrative as strategists, as spiritual leaders, as rebels, healers, and organizers. Is that something that reflects a larger and more respected position of women in African societies?
Well, it reflects the fact that women were very highly valued in African society. And I should say there is a phenomenon of African slavery, which is internal to the continent, which pre-exists chattel slavery. Now, this is a complicated subject because in some senses, this internal African enslavery tradition overlaps with chattel slavery. But it is at the same time different. And one of the differences is that in Atlantic slavery, men were valued more highly than women, whereas in the internal African system, women were valued more highly than men. That's partly because slavery in Africa is not purely economic. It's to do with a number of other factors. But women do play this very important role in the resistance movement, and they do so all the time throughout the period and across a very wide range of activities.
And why do you think women played such a large role?
Well, they are partly much more strategically placed. For example, if you think of the slave plantation, women are very often inside the house. They are therefore able to gather intelligence and help strategize in terms of organizing a revolt or rebellion. But also, women are actually much more natural networkers. And a large number of the revolts that I was able to describe and analyze were based on these informal forms of solidarity that existed among enslaved communities. This was another big discovery of mine, because, of course, when you think about slavery, there's a very famous historian who has described it as a form of social death. And you assume that because of that, enslaved people are disconnected from each other. But in fact, they constantly tried to retain relationships amongst themselves, and women were a really important factor in enabling those relationships to be sustained.
Those kinds of connections were made not just between slaves, but also between, in some cases, poor whites, certainly Native Americans, the indigenous peoples. So, talk about the networks that existed, and what surprised you most about some of these cross-boundary alliances?
Well, I'll give you one example which really blew my mind. And this is one of the earliest and largest runaway settlements in Brazil in the 17th century. It's called Palmares. And it's set up in the first few decades of the 17th century, initially just by a group of about 40 African men and women who have escaped from the northeastern Brazilian coast and formed this little community in the hinterland. Eventually, Palmares grows into really a very large collection of settlements. I think at its height, there are nine different villages. The total population is about 10, 15, some people even think 20,000. And it developed a very complex system of administration. It had a justice system. It produced crops, surpluses, which it traded with local white settlers. And it also attracted poor whites from the coast who actually wanted to be part of a community in which people were living on a more humane basis than in the slaver societies. And what was most fascinating about Palmares was that the enslaved fugitives cohabited with Native American populations. And the traditions, the cultural, the military traditions that they developed blended Native American techniques with techniques which had come from Africa.
Could you give an example?
So, for example, the names of the villages are Native American in some cases. One of them is called Subupira. And when you look at the fighting techniques of the Maroons of Palmares, they use techniques and weapons which they have developed in cooperation with Native American. So it's a synergy which helps Palmares actually survive until the very end of the 17th century. It's finally defeated in 1694. But, you know, they have managed to resist, on average, a military raid every 18 months or so from the mid 17th century.
That's something that also occurred quite a lot in North America here.
Yes, very much so. And in fact, of course, tragically, a lot of these Native American communities were decimated by disease, by enslavement. But we now know, for example, in modern day Haiti, when the Spaniards first arrived in Hispaniola in the 1500s, among the people who resisted were, of course, the first group of Africans who were brought to Hispaniola. But they resisted along with the Taino people who were there and who were being enslaved by the Spaniards. And we have many examples across the 1500s of runaway Africans cooperating with Taino communities in resisting Spanish slavers.
I want to come back to the Haitian Revolution, but first, Sudhir Hazara Singh, in Daring to be Free, you describe resistance as operating through notions of autonomy, dignity, self-rule, and honor. How did enslaved people cultivate and sustain these values under conditions that were explicitly designed to crush them?
Well, I think one of the things that they do is to create a separation between themselves and the world of enslavement. And therefore, sometimes that requires looking as if you're going along with what the system is asking you to do, but in a sense, almost creating a parallel world. Because although slavers tried to establish a form of complete domination over the lives, the thoughts, and the actions of enslaved men and women, they couldn't control them completely. So there were always opportunities for these people to find moments where they could cultivate their own religious beliefs and practices, also converse in their native African languages. So it's this separation, this autonomy, which they develop and sustain, which helps them both retain a sense of who they were, but also at times organize forms of active resistance.
The Haitian Revolution, of course, I think it plays, well, first of all, plays a central role in your narrative, but also in the minds of people when they think about resistance. As you said before, it's seen as the only successful anti-slavery revolution. I remember when I was a kid back in the previous century that I had this wonderful book that actually had a huge impact on me. There were a series of history books. I used to get one a month in the mail, and one of them was about Toussaint Louverture. And it was the first time that I, in fact, got an inkling that people who had been enslaved had successfully been able to fight against it. You revisit Haiti through the lens of rank-and-file resistance rather than only iconic leaders like Louverture. How does that change our understanding of that revolution's character?
Well, I did both, in a way. I wrote a biography of Toussaint Louverture about 5 years ago, and concentrated on, as it were, the leadership aspects of the Haitian Revolution. And then I realized that this kind of leadership was only made possible because it was completely in tune with the aspirations, the beliefs, and the dreams of the ordinary men and women who were emancipated in Saint-Domingue, as Haiti was called before independence, as from the early 1790s. So once I started to explore the revolutionary actions of the rank and file, I could see the extraordinary richness of the Haitian Revolution and how it enabled men like Louverture and later Dessalines to basically unite their people in their struggle against slavery and then eventually for independence from France.
Now, you note that Haiti actually became a symbol of black power, a kind of beacon to enslave people throughout the Americas, and also, of course, a terror to the enslavers. How did the information about Haiti actually circulate among enslaved communities throughout the Atlantic region?
Well, that was fascinating because, of course, this was not yet the age of social media. But at the same time, information travels remarkably quickly. You see that from the very beginning of the Haitian Revolution in 1791, when there's a massive insurrection of enslaved men and women, the stories start to circulate in the region, in the United States. Very, very quickly. Part of it happens through the activities of sailors. There are a lot of connections, maritime connections, among the different territories. So news travels in part by this way. But once the revolution begins in Saint-Domingue, you also have people who emigrate, leave Saint-Domingue, and end up in neighboring islands or in the United States. And they also keep in touch with people who remain in Saint-Domingue, and they, through them, information circulates. And of course, this information often gets amplified, exaggerated. And so the legend of the Haitian Revolution becomes this very awe-inspiring phenomenon.
Awe-inspiring to people who were oppressed, terrifying to the enslavers and to global imperialism, even down to today. I mean, I have heard people argue that Haiti is in the position that it is today. Number one, because is it still paying off the debt to France, where you would think that the enslaved should have gotten compensation, but no, in fact, they're still paying off the debt. But also the way in which Haiti has been treated by global powers ever since the revolution.
Absolutely. And the Haitians, unfortunately, paid a very heavy price for daring to be free. And first of all, the French imposed this terrible tribute in 1825 as a condition for diplomatic recognition. And it basically took the Haitians most of the 19th century and part of the 20th to repay this. But of course, the United States also got involved. Woodrow Wilson invaded and basically tried to turn Haiti into an American colony. And so this constant external intervention destabilized Haitian society, the Haitian economy, and also encouraged the sort of dictatorships which have tragically marked the modern history of Haiti. So when people talk about Haiti being in such a difficult situation, we have to remember that a large part of this is down to the imperial interventions of all those groups that never forgave the Haitians for their fight for international justice.
And Sudhir Hazare is saying, let's talk a little bit about abolition. Now, of course, this happened first in Britain and then later in the United States. But you argue that it was the people who were enslaved who were the true abolitionists. So, how does this challenge longstanding myths in Europe and the US that credit abolition primarily to white reformers?
Well, in a way, the very term abolitionist, to my mind, is a misnomer because most of the abolitionists of the 18th century and the early 19th century were people who were sincerely opposed to slavery, of course. I'm not doubting that at all. But when you look at what they were saying, most of them thought that slavery should be actually abolished gradually in the long term. And many of them believed that this would happen spontaneously because it was economically inefficient. The people who consistently argued for the immediate end to chattel slavery were the enslaved themselves. And they were the ones who campaigned for it, fought for it. And my argument in the book is that it is through their pressure that the white abolitionists eventually agreed to end slavery. And this pressure is through campaigning, but it's also through the revolts and the rebellions that we see not only in Haiti, but all the way through the Caribbean, the Americas, and the United States.
And it kind of reminds me a century later of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's letter from the Birmingham jail, in which he excoriated the white liberals who also argued for gradualism when it came to granting civil rights to black people in the US.
Very much so. And in fact, there's a very striking analogy between the struggle against slavery, the struggle against colonialism, and the struggle against racism in the second half of the 20th century. The arguments used by the people who want to preserve white supremacy are identical. It's the same claim that they're making, which is that black people are inferior. They're not yet ready to have full sovereignty or to exercise their rights, and therefore white supremacy has to be maintained. And you see that also in South Africa under apartheid. So this is a story which has tragically been repeated over and over again. But the forms of resistance which were initiated by the enslaved were the ones that actually inspired both the people fighting against colonialism and people like the Reverend King fighting for civil rights in the 1950s and 1960s.
And finally, your conclusion in this book, Daring to Be Free, you title it Honoring Our Debts. What are the debts that contemporary societies, especially, of course, the former colonial powers, owe to the generations of enslaved people who dared to be free?
Well, I think one debt is a debt of memory. I think we need to honor the past and tell the story of this resistance as it happened, rather than through these myths that we have cultivated for so long, namely that abolition happened because reformers wanted it, rather than it happening because the enslaved fought for it. But I think we also need to have a conversation about material reparations. These conversations are ongoing in various societies, and it's something that I think can only be worked out through discussion between former enslavers and their descendants, and the descendants of the enslaved. But there are, of course, very powerful demands that have been made by African states, Caribbean states, and also in the United States. And I think those demands have to be taken very seriously.
And I said finally before, but actually, I have one more question, which is, what are some of the lessons as, we in the United States face a fight to preserve our democracy against the forces of authoritarianism, really of fascism? What can we learn from the resistance of the enslaved in the Atlantic world?
Well, I think that's a very important question because the kind of authoritarian that you're unfortunately facing in the United States is one that is on the rise in Europe as well. And I think the enslaved have many things to teach us. One is that you have to remain strong, even when you're facing very powerful and, as it were, materially superior forces. You have to retain your strength. The other thing is not to be divided, not to allow the people who are trying to divide you on, say, ethnic or religious grounds to triumph. Because the extraordinary thing about the enslaved is that they came from so many different backgrounds and religious experiences, but they came together and fought off their oppression. So this emphasis on unity is something that always allowed the enslaved to keep their heads up. And I think if we do the same, there is hope for us all.
Well, that is a great note to end on. This is really a terrific book, Daring to Be Free: Rebellion and Resistance of the Enslaved in the Atlantic World. Thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me, Francesca.
Sudhir Hazara Singh is a fellow of the British Academy and has been a fellow and tutor in politics at Balliol College, Oxford, since 1990. In addition to Daring to Be Free, he's the author of several other books, including the award-winning Black Spartacus. Next up, Sojourner Truth, as seen through fiction. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. In our first segment today, Sudhir Hazara Singh pointed out that many of the key figures of resistance among enslaved people were women. One of the greatest was abolitionist and former slave Sojourner Truth. Truth was born in New York State as Elizabeth Bomefree. But she has a special connection to a place where I used to live, Northampton, Massachusetts. Truth resided there during a crucial period of her life when she began to come into her own as a leader in the abolitionist movement. Back in 2012, I spoke with novelist Jacqueline Sheehan about her novel about Sojourner Truth. Originally issued in 2003 under a different title, Sheehan reissued it in 2011. Under the name The Comet's Tale. I asked her why she changed the title.
Well, in the very beginning of the book, one of the ways that I wanted to show the kind of the way that an enslaved parent would try to stay connected with her children was that the mother would tell a story about each child's birth. And I fictionalized a story that Sojourner's mother would have told her about her birth. And that story was that she arrived on a comet's tail.
This was a story that you have some reason to believe that she would have told her, or it was one that was just made up out of whole cloth by you?
Yeah, no, it was just made up by me. But I do believe that oral tradition is how parents stayed connected with their children by telling them stories about the other children who were sold away. And stories of their birth.
Actually, Sojourner Truth's mother is quite a powerful figure in this book, and her father too, less so. Did you know anything about them? I mean, is this also something that you got from the research that you did, which I understand you did a lot of research about this? Did you find out things about Sojourner Truth's parents?
Mostly what I was able to find out about her parents, and it took me 5 years of writing and research to do this book, came from her narrative that she dictated to Olive Gilbert right across the river in Florence, Massachusetts. Because there would not have been much at all written about Sojourner's parents since they were regarded as property.
Now, Sojourner Truth, we're going to call her Sojourner Truth, although she didn't get that name until she was already a grown up. She was born Isabella into slavery in New York, in Dutch New York. Dutch was actually her first language. Could you paint a portrait for us of what her life was like as a child, as a slave child, living with her parents on this this farm?
You know, that was really the most compelling part of the story. And it, for me, it was an untold part of her life. You know, and as a psychologist, it's the question I always want to know with people who have that sort of resiliency and they survive unbelievable things in their childhood. But I want to know, how did you survive? What did it take for you to survive? What pulled you through? And I wanted to know that about Sojourner Truth. And again, this took a lot of research about especially how Northern slaves were treated in general, which was not one bit better than Southern slaves, although I think the people in the North wanted to think that they were treating slaves better, and really, we were not. How children were regarded as compared to, say, livestock. So I wanted to paint a picture of what it was like to grow up as a female slave child under those conditions, also knowing that at any minute you were going to be sold away from your parents.
In fact, there's a part early in the book when Isabella is a child and she's really being treated like livestock. Well, not livestock. She's being treated as if she is a dog.
Mm-hmm.
And her mother gets very indignant.
So there's information that I could have presented in a very academic kind of way, but I did not want to do that. The whole point of historical fiction is that readers can enter the character and learn from the character what this kind of life was like. So I could have gone on and on about the research that I had done about how slave children were of lesser or equal value to livestock or to a well-trained dog, a herding dog. But instead, you know, I fictionalized an account that let Isabella experience this. And she does not have political knowledge. She doesn't have the knowledge of what's happening in the bigger picture. She has knowledge like any 8-year-old child would have. And yes, this would have been the thing that would, I think, would have put her mother, Mau Mau Bet, over the edge.
So then, was she about 12 when she was actually sold away from her parents?
She was between 9 and 10 when she was sold from her parents because of the death of one of the slave masters. And they sold off all of their possessions, including these children.
And then she went to a much more difficult circumstances. And you paint a portrait here also, the slave owner's wife, who is quite uncomfortable with her role as a slave owner. And rather than that making her more humane, it actually makes her less humane.
Well, yeah. And again, you know, it's that dehumanizing people so that we can call them slaves dehumanizes the people we call slaves, but it also dehumanizes us. And that's what I was trying to show with these scenes. So here is this wife, a powerless, completely powerless person in society at that time, unable to vote, really unable to speak in public. And she is put into this position of managing a slave child and really does not know how to do that. Not all families did. And this was a merchant who had just become wealthy enough that finally he could attain a slave child. And it was dehumanizing to everyone.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sojourner Truth, who was still at this time called Isabella, slavery was on its way out in New York, but she managed to almost free herself a year earlier. How did that come about?
Isabella was an extremely powerful, physically powerful person, and she was famous for her physical prowess. And John Dumont, who owned her, you know, would brag about her. He would brag about her strength. And say things like, you know, she says, you know, as strong as a man, but yet she can work domestically in the house. Wow, what a bargain I've got. But she was aware of this, and she was beginning to have a consciousness, I think, of what was fair. So all of the Black people in the area knew that slavery was coming to an end in New York State. And so Isabella had this conversation with John Dumont, and she said, look, I have worked unbelievably hard for you. I would like to become free a year early. I've earned it. And they had a sort of relationship that, you know, they could have conversations of some depth, according to her. And he had promised her this. And when he reneged on his promise, she saw him suddenly in a different light, that not only had he owned slaves, but he had lied to her. And that was the line in the sand for her.
He wasn't her friend, actually.
No.
Then she went off and ultimately got to New York City for a while. What was she doing in New York City?
Well, she was working as a domestic, but working for herself, deciding who she would want to work for. But she was also in New York City in this time period of great religious enlightenment. It was a really exciting time to be in New York City. And she was very swept up in it. And in her effort to be able to speak to God, to become a religious person, she ultimately made some horrible choices.
She got involved in a kind of cult.
In a cult. Can't call it anything else.
Yeah. And you know, the resonance of Sojourner Truth's life is very modern in some ways. You know, it seemed like the first New Age movement in a way, with all kinds of, you know, people who were sincere, but also people who were charlatans.
And if you think about Sojourner Truth's position, she's still Isabella at this point, but up until age 30, she had been owned by other people. She had been told who she could have children with, who she couldn't have children with. Really, all of her choices were dictated to her. She had a sense of being able to talk to God because she really got that from her mother, who instructed her, no matter what happens, you can talk to God. And I think she held on to that, but she was not permitted to go to church. So freedom comes to New York State. She goes down to New York City, takes her very damaged son, Peter, with her. And she, I think, wants to take this ability to become a spiritual person as far as she can take it. And she runs into this group that is enthralled with somebody called Matthias, who claims really to be able to have contact with God in this very personal way and be able to interpret the word of God. And she makes the choice, like these other actually very well-educated, well-informed people, to believe him. Mm-hmm.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Jacqueline Sheehan about Sojourner Truth. Her novel about truth is The Comet's Tale. So what happened then? I mean, things began to fall apart when they moved to upstate New York.
Well, they moved to what was then Sing Sing. And he was operating out of the cult playbook, really, I think. You know, he was dictating to them who they could mate with, who could sleep with who. He was dictating what they could eat. And of course, all of their finances were going to him. I think we've heard this story before, and we'll hear it in the next few centuries. But she had a kind of loyalty to him. And the entire group blew apart when one of the members became sick and died.
Mm. And she left and she became involved with another cult, with the Millerites.
Yeah, not very much, though. She was not involved with the Millerites very much. She was very cautious after being involved with Matthias. She still attended church. You know, she really became a seeker. I don't know what else to call her, but she was a seeker of spirituality.
And she had a kind of religious epiphany, which is how she got her name, Sojourner Truth.
She was in her mid-40s, and God spoke to her. And God said to her, I'm renaming you. I'm naming you Sojourner Truth. And the rest of your life is to be a preacher, to bring the word of God to other people. And that's what happened.
Now, she could not read or write. She was illiterate.
Mm-hmm.
But she was a powerful speaker, I understand.
You know, that is my deepest regret, is that we have no recording of her voice. When I was doing research, every newspaper account that I read of what her voice was like was some variation of the reporter saying, the hair on the back of my neck stood up when I heard her voice. And she would usually end her speech with a song. She would sing, and apparently she had a beautiful, resonant, inspiring voice.
Mm. Well, the Millerites, which we mentioned before, they were a kind of a millennial cult. Mm-hmm. That's what brought her up to this neck of the woods.
Mm-hmm.
How did she make her way from New York to Northampton?
Well, she went through Connecticut. So she was preaching and asking about, she was looking for a place. It's amazing that she had this much faith after having, you know, found a group that blew up and was disastrous, that she was still looking for a group, and she would always do that the rest of her life. So I think her last stop as she was coming up through Connecticut and Massachusetts was someplace in Chicopee, and she was talking with somebody, and they said, "You sound like the kind of person who should go to Florence," and described where that was. And she continued walking, and she arrived in the Florence, Northampton area.
And what did she find there?
She found the Association for Education and Industry in Florence, which was a utopian community, and it was based on one person, one vote. What she particularly liked was that everyone had to do an equal share of work, and she was pretty delighted with that when she found it. She always said there was no high, no low in this particular group.
This was also a group that was in favor. It wasn't just a utopian community. They were also active in the abolition movement. And she met two great Black anti-slavery fighters, and that was Frederick Douglass and David Ruggles. Tell us a little bit about her interaction with these two men.
She was older than Frederick Douglass. And, you know, Frederick Douglass was a very well-educated, fantastic speaker. And I think he felt that Sojourner Truth could sort of get on his case a little bit. And he sometimes reprimanded her for that. He got on sort of a high horse with her about it because, you know, he looked at her as she couldn't read, she couldn't write. And it was important for him politically to be seen as a very well-educated man. So I don't think he always wanted to affiliate with her. With David Ruggles, however, he was one of the most interesting people who I found in history. He was a Black abolitionist. He had started out in New York City helping people on the Underground Railroad. Actually, he helped Frederick Douglass. But he was sort of a frail person, and he became ill in New York City and began to lose his sight. He was quite blind at one point. But he was an unusually brave person, and he made the decision, well, I'm going blind, but I think I will just continue to operate on the Underground Railroad and try and save as many people as I can. Well, his friends said, "David, you have to be, you've just lost your mind, we think, because you have a price on your head. People would willingly kill you. You're going blind." And they sort of escorted him up to Florence, where he regained a bit of his health. He opened a water cure hotel in Florence, of which there were several.
So Sojourner Truth also now blended religion with her anti-slavery work.
She did. I think her political sense was really developed in Florence. She was surrounded by abolitionists. She was surrounded by this kind of talk and exposure to what was happening politically. And she did. She blended it with her sense of spirituality, with her sense of justice. It was not just the abolitionist movement. It was the right of women to be able to vote. And in her later years, she fought against capital punishment.
Wow. And we're talking about Sojourner Truth. We're talking with Jacqueline Sheehan about her novel, The Comet's Tale, a novel about Sojourner Truth. And she bought a house in Northampton. She lived there with her two daughters, or two of her daughters. But then she left. Why did she go, and where did she go?
Again, she was looking for a community of like-minded people. So she moved to Battle Creek, Michigan. She was most affiliated with Quakers, but she was now on a full-time lecture tour, not over the entire United States, but definitely the Northeast, as far out as Michigan and back again. She was also very involved in supporting soldiers, especially Black soldiers, in the Civil War.
And did she meet Lincoln?
She did meet Lincoln. And I did I could only fictionalize that meeting because we don't know exactly what that was like. There are many different accounts of it. There is her account of it. There is another person's account of it that does not particularly jive with Sojourner's. Sojourner was completely taken with him. Other people have said that the issue of slavery for him was very, very complicated, and that it was not that he was completely against slavery. He very much wanted to keep our country together.
Right, but then he did free the slaves. He did the right thing. People don't always do the right thing for the right reasons. Mm-hmm. But therein lies historical progress. This book, you know, Jacqueline Sheehan, we've talked about a number of your other books now and then. I mean, I think we've had you on maybe at least two other times, perhaps three. I do now see, which I hadn't before, the common thread. You've been a psychologist. You deal with issues of abuse and resilience. So, of course, that very much is a story of that. I found this book, you know, I've enjoyed all your other ones, but this one I found incredibly powerful. I almost felt that you're really in love with this character, with this person. I wonder, is there something about the fact that you were writing a historical novel about an iconic figure in American history that made her really special to you as a character?
I think what I wanted to do is I wanted to not have her be an iconic character, that there was something accessible to all of us about the choices that she made, that you can have horrible life circumstances, and that you can make choices. For example, she went through a period in her life when she hated white people. You know, that would sort of be a logical conclusion. But because of her ability to kind of see the goodness in people, she really chose that instead. I mean, she could choose to hate a particular group of people, or she could choose to see the goodness in everybody. She was not blind to the negative parts of people. That wasn't the case. So I particularly wanted people to know her childhood, which to me is always the most compelling part of somebody's life for some reason. And I did want people to see that, yes, she was one of the movers and shakers of the 19th century. But every single one of us can make the kind of choices, can be courageous, can make a choice for the better instead of for the worse.
That was Jacqueline Sheehan talking with me in 2012 about her novel, The Comet's Tale, about Sojourner Truth.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.